Welcome to the podcast of the Geological Society. In this episode, we catch up with October's Shell London lecturer, Dr. Rosalind Rickaby, who explains how a tiny marine organism called a coccolithophore can have a big influence on climate. First, what's the weather like on Mars? It may be nearly 400 million kilometres away, but geologists are using their unique understanding of Earth to try and understand questions like these. Sarah Day talks to Dr. Mac Balm from the Open University and the Planetary Science Institute in Arizona.
Understanding the Martian climate is really important. At least over the last few tens of million years, it seems to be the thing that's driving the geology, the interaction between the surface and the atmosphere. Really, we've only got the Earth to go by as an analogue for Mars.
And is there a lot similar about Earth and Mars?
Oh, absolutely. Parts of the desert southwest of the US look just like the pictures that the rovers have taken on Mars. You know, just from that surface appearance, they're very similar. And of course, the physics is the same throughout the solar system, throughout the universe. So, you know, if you have sand grains and volcanoes and lava, it acts in the same way, plus or minus a bit for different gravity or different air pressure. But the same rules of physics apply.
So what are you working on at the moment?
At the moment, I'm working on what's called periglacial environments. That's permafrost environments that have a bit of melting associated with them. The search for water is really the guiding principle. You know, follow the water is the mantra of the Mars program. And the reason we do that is because we think that all forms of life as we know it need liquid water. So we're very interested to find out where zones of habitability could be on Mars and when. And the other thing I do is chase dust devils around in Arizona and Nevada. And dust devils are little mini whirlwinds, and you see them on Mars. And so we have a truck that we chase dust devils around. So I spend a few months a year in the US in the blazing sun recording dust devils and getting hot and bothered.
Comparing those with Mars.
Absolutely. The reason we want to understand dust devils on Mars is Mars's atmosphere is very dusty. And it's not just dusty during dust storms, it's dusty all the time. And the climate models struggle to reproduce that dustiness within the sort of the computer models. So we want to be able to find a simple way of putting dust devils into our climate models. And then if we can do that, then we can reproduce how Mars's atmosphere works. We can predict the weather, makes it safer for, you know, entry vehicles. Because, you know, one of the theories as to why Beagle didn't make it was simply because we didn't have a good enough handle on, you know, the atmosphere.
So what you really want to do is be a weather forecaster for Mars.
Well, I mean, not myself.
Not you.
I mean, I tend to come at these things from looking at the surface, but the people I work with are meteorologists. So again, you know, it's a team of people with different skills and different interests. So trying to solve a big problem.
And manned missions, is that a long way off?
It still seems to me that humans going to Mars would be the best way to answer these questions. But at the same time, I'm thinking to myself, do I really want to abandon all these amazing unmanned missions that can tell us so much? I heard a figure recently that it would be $500 billion for a manned mission to Mars, which is a huge amount of money. And for the same amount, you could have 500 top-class unmanned missions. But as a, you know, person who's been out in the field on Earth, you can do things as a human being in 5 minutes that would take a rover hundreds of days. Actually having humans on the surface in terms of getting scientific answers would just be fantastic. There would just be no way of comparing it. But on, you know, the other side of it is that we have so much data from NASA and European missions and not enough geologists to look at it. You know, when it comes down to it, great science can be done with data that we've been collecting over the last 15, 20 years. Not having a mission for 2 or 3 years and actually spending money on the scientists to analyse that data could be a good strategy.
So what's the big thing that people are working on now? What's the next stage?
There's that big picture, you know, the how did Mars evolve question, which we still don't have a great handle on. Why is there the northern lowlands and the southern highlands? Was there a giant ocean early in Mars's history? Volcanoes, were they all old or are they still occurring now? Is there active volcanism? Permafrost, rivers, lakes, little springs, melting ice, glaciers, going back even further, groundwater, ancient oceans. You know, maybe life got going and then stopped. We just don't know. And until we can really understand the Martian sort of geological evolution, we won't really have a good handle on being able to do the biology.
That was Dr. Matt Balm talking at this year's British Science Festival. Back on Earth, the relationship between geology, biology and climate is equally important, particularly as carbon dioxide emissions continue to rise. When carbon dioxide dissolves in oceans, it lowers the pH, making ocean waters more acidic. This can have devastating consequences for marine organisms such as corals, which need to make calcium carbonate shells. Until recently, scientists thought that the calcifying organisms wouldn't be able to cope if the ocean waters continued to become more acidic. But one tiny organism might be proving them wrong. Sarah Day talks to Dr. Rosalind Rickaby from the University of Oxford, who is fascinated by the complex relationship between marine organisms, ocean chemistry, and the Earth's climate.
Explain to me what a coccolithophore is.
Okay, so it's a tiny organism that lives in the ocean, and it's like a plant in the ocean, so it undertakes photosynthesis, and it lives in the surface ocean, fixing carbon from CO2 or carbon dioxide in the environment and making its calcium carbonate platelets, so these beautifully disc-like platelets which it amasses on the surface of its cell to create what we term a coccosphere. They're absolutely microscopic. You would never see them if you just took a glass full of seawater, but you can see them by satellite from way out, and huge accumulations of them make the chalk cliffs of the south of England. So despite being tiny, they have a big influence on the world.
What is it about them that's so important to the oceans and ocean chemistry?
Okay, they're an incredibly important part of ocean chemistry because they're responsible for about anywhere between 20 to 80% of the calcium carbonate that's produced in open ocean waters. They're responsible for using up carbon, fixing it into their organic matter, which then drops out of the surface ocean and acts as a biological pump of carbon. On long geological timescales, the coccolithophores act as a store of carbon.
They're using this carbon to form their shells. So one would think that in a world where we're emitting more carbon, that would be a good thing for them. Is that not the case?
That's a really good question, and it's something that the jury is still out in the scientific community. The coccolithophore is doing two things with carbon. One, it's photosynthesizing, so it's using carbon dioxide to photosynthesize and fix into its organic matter. And then it's also using carbon, probably in the form of the bicarbonate ion, to calcify. And so, yes, you would have thought that the more CO2 that was available, the more carbon, then great, it can do everything it needs to do. But the importance of the coccolithophores is that they take what we term alkalinity out of the ocean. And they use up that alkalinity to make their calcium carbonate skeleton. As I say, the challenge of acidification is that it's, in essence, decreasing the saturation state of the ocean, which arguably makes it harder for the coccolithophore to calcify. And so this is where the challenge in understanding how they're going to respond comes, because we, on the one side, we might think, wow, they're going to be fertilised because it's easier for them to photosynthesise. But on the other side, we think, oh, well, crikey, it's harder for them to calcify. So which of these things wins? There is some evidence to suggest that the coccolithophores are actually extending their abundance in the ocean towards higher latitudes in the poles. And not only that, but we've done some work in Oxford where we looked at the ability of coccoliths to calcify over the last 200 years, and we found that they seem to be increasing their degree of calcification as ocean acidification has been proceeding, so exactly opposite to what we might expect. So one possibility indeed is that they're being fertilised photosynthetically, which is giving them more energy to be able to calcify. But the other option that seems to be coming out of the literature or the results at the moment is that there may be a whole range of different almost morphotypes of coccolithophore, and there are some morphotypes which really calcify quite a lot, and they're pre-adapted almost to ocean acidification. And so that would be an alternative explanation, that we're selecting for the coccolithophores which are better adapted and calcify more under low pH conditions.
So it's not all bad for the
coccolithophore. No. What's very interesting about the coccolithophores and also the diatoms which live in the ocean is they seem to evolve incredibly fast. A coccolith lives for 2 weeks, so you've got the potential for a genetic mutation every 2 weeks as part of that population. And the challenge of humans is that obviously we've got a long lifespan, so our potential to evolve is slower biologically, but really the part that will be slow to evolve is the infrastructure of human society. We've built up farming patterns, roads, where we live over the last 10,000 years, a relatively stable climate, and the challenge is this is the biggest change that we're going to have seen as a society. Geology is kind of saying, oh, I don't mind this problem, you know, I've seen this before, I can deal with it, it's just going to take me a while. You know, we really just speeded stuff up, and that's what's giving us all these problems.
So they'll probably outlive us all.
Yes.
Rosalind Rickaby was talking to Sarah Day following her Shell London lecture, Perturbing Plankton in the Sea, Past and Future, which can be viewed with all our other past lectures on the Geological Society's website. Next month, Shell lecturer Tony Watts explores the mysteries of mountains under the sea, potential causes of earthquakes and tsunamis. They are also hotspots of biodiversity.